Hi, welcome to another episode of New Books in Islamic Studies. I'm your host, Christian Peterson. For each program, we choose a new book that's especially interesting, and we chat with the author of that book. For this program, I had the pleasure of speaking with Martin Nguyen about his great new book, Sufi Master and Quran Scholar Abul Qasim al-Qushayri and al-Lataif al-Isharat, which was published by Oxford University Press in 2012. The famous Abul Qasim al-Qushayri is well known as one of the most influential figures in the formative period of Sufism. He was part of a network of prominent Sufis in Nishapur that were shaping the competing forms of spirituality during the 11th century. Due to this noteworthy role in Sufism, Qushayri's work has rarely been examined within the context of the concurrent and intimately connected traditions with which he was engaged. Martin Nguyen has meticulously reconstructed the nexus of Qushayri's intellectual field through a close examination of his Quran commentary, the Lataif al-Isharat, or the Subtleties of the Signs. Nguyen draws Qushayri's legal training in the Shafi'i madhhab and his theological positioning in the Asri school to the surface. He also demonstrates that Qushayri had a continuing exegetical corpus and was long committed to Quranic commentary. As the final iteration of his tafsir, the Lataif points to Qushayri's alignment with the Nishapuri collective of exegetical hermeneutics. Some of the various issues Nguyen's close reading explores include the clear and ambiguous Quran verses, the notion of abrogation, the ascension narrative, the disconnected letters in the Quran, the narrative of Job, anthropomorphism, and the masperine-aspirant relationship. In our conversation, we also discuss the notion of tradition, exploring archives and manuscripts, composition and audience, the notion of attribution, exoteric versus esoteric commentaries, and Nguyen's great website, Islamicana. Without further ado, here's the interview. Hi, and welcome to another episode of New Books in Islamic Studies. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with Martin Nguyen about his great new book, Sufi Master and Quran Scholar, Abul Qasim al-Qushayri and the Lataif al-Isharat. Welcome, Martin. How are you?
Oh, very good. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks for making some time to talk to me. I think you've really produced a tremendous book here, and I appreciate all the hard work. It's a real piece of serious scholarship, and you've definitely advanced our knowledge of Qushayri and Quranic studies more generally, so thank you very much. Before we kind of delve in, though, would you mind kind of giving us a little bit of background about how you got interested in Islamic studies, people that might have been influential in the way you approach the topic or kind of the subject matters that you're interested in?
Oh, sure. I guess it really began in undergraduate when I was at the University of Virginia. I was taking my elective courses and ran across a religious studies course being offered by Professor Abdulaziz Sajidina. And one class with him pretty much led to a series of others. And from there, I just became very interested in studying the religious traditions in general. And as many know, you know, UVA has a fantastic religion department. From there, I pursued a master's of theological studies at Harvard Divinity School, where I studied quite a bit of Christian theology in addition to Islamic studies. But it was during that period where I fine-tuned my interests. I really discovered that my passion was for pursuing the Islamic intellectual tradition in the pre-modern period, trying to understand, you know, where all of these contemporary situations we're dealing with, how did they form, where did they emerge from? And from there, I went on to do the PhD at Harvard at the Center for Mideast Studies. It's a joint program where it's between Mideast Studies and History. I worked with Roy Motahede, and my dissertation committee eventually also included Shahab Ahmed and Jim Morris over at Boston College. And it was really just, my exposure to the very kind of interdisciplinary approach that's available at Harvard that led me to working on Qushayri and developing the book that we have now. Essentially, and during the course of all of this, I also discovered that my greatest interest was with the mystical tradition, with Sufism. But it wasn't just simply with Sufism itself, but how did it interrelate to the other aspects of the tradition, right? How do the other religious sciences contribute, shape, and influence the formation of Sufism, and vice versa? In what way did mystical thought have an impact on other lines of development?
Yeah, and I think you really do a great job of, within the book of tying these traditions together. And I think if we can follow in your footsteps, we'll be doing much better. Can you talk a little bit of how this specific project emerged? Maybe was it part of your course development that you were introduced into Kocheri's work? Or
oh yes. Well, I was always interested in studying the Quran and looking at the many traditions of interpretation that have developed over time. And so the field of tafsir was something that was relatively, not new, but was gaining more and more traction. I think more and more scholars were beginning to become interested in doing tafsir studies. There are obviously incredible work being done in the decades preceding my own time. But I think around the time when I began to develop a dissertation topic focused on Kocheri, tafsir in general was pretty much getting more attention. And I realized, if you really want to understand how different traditions engage with the larger meta tradition of Islam, you have to look to scripture, right? The Quran is an anchor of sorts. And the field of tafsir gives us some insight into how different scholars from whatever field, be it philosophy or theology, be it from the legal tradition, how do they deal with tafsir, right? How are they dealing with these verses of the Quran? And so I was actually entertaining a variety of different scholars. I was looking at Taburi for a while, but it was during a seminar with Shahab Ahmed that Kocheri was brought to my attention. And so I took a look at this, right? It's not an incredibly overwhelming tafsir, right? It's not like Taburi al-Tha'labi, where you're dealing with just, a dozen volumes or so of texts. Rather, with Kocheri, you're dealing with in most printings, a three-volume tafsir. So it's not incredibly short. It's manageable. And as I began to look at this text, I realized that this is an extremely rich and interesting tafsir when it comes to the Sufi tradition. But it also contains so much more. And I think that's what really captivated me. I saw that there was potential here to study this one scholar and how he engages with the Quran in this specific commentary. I could extrapolate from that, right, all these other various influences. What does the web of influence actually look like in terms of forming this particular text? And so I continued onwards, just plowing through the Lata'if and seeing what was there.
Can you just briefly introduce us to Kocheri? Who was he?
Well, Kocheri is typically remembered as a Sufi master, right? He's seen as a spiritual teacher of great influence. He's from the 11th century, or dies in 1072. And he's often seen as part of that spiritual lineage, right, that leads to other great spiritual masters like Abu Hamid al-Ghazali and so on. His most famous work, or the work by which he is most well known today, is this text called the Risala, a treatise on Sufism. And it's an interesting text, right? It provides a biographical dictionary of who were the great luminaries that lead up to the Sufi tradition, that developed the Sufi tradition in all its various forms and shapes. It provides a lexicon of terminology, that this is the specific language and the vocabulary that the Sufis actually used. And it goes through some major issues, theological issues, that Sufis had to deal with, of trying to make sense of, right? Like miracles or saints, or friends of gods, the awliya. And while I thought Kocheri was important in this respect, here you have this tafsir that has endured down through the centuries, the Lata'if al-Ishrat, which has gained very little attention. There have been studies prior to my own work, right? You have Annabel Keeler's important text, Christian Science has given attention to it, among others. But there hadn't been kind of an in-depth look at this one text. And so when I wanted to look at this, I thought, well, if we're going to appreciate the Lata'if al-Ishrat, we have to appreciate Kocheri. And Kocheri, right, while he is a Sufi master, he is more than that. When you look at his background, his educational training, he's trained as a traditional Shafi scholar, right? He's part of a legal tradition. He receives the classical training you would expect of any jurist. He also studies theology. We find that he's also very committed to the Ash'ari school of theology, right? His teachers are among the great masters who disseminate the school from Baghdad into Khorasan, right? Eastwards into Central Asia. And so you see that Kushiri, well, yes, he's a Sufi master. Part of his pedigree, part of his training is very much also within the legal tradition, the theological tradition. He receives, you know, the training that you would expect of any religious scholar in terms of language. He studies hadith and he studies the Quran. And so Kushiri, well, yes, a Sufi master, also has kind of this consummate education that any Sunni scholar would actually receive, at least for this time period.
Now, but before we get into some of the sources that you're actually using, since I'm the host and I can ask you whatever questions I want,
sure.
There was one footnote that really struck me personally, because I'm really interested in this notion of tradition.
Well, I'm glad you're reading the footnotes.
You have this rather extended footnote on the notion of tradition, and while it's a footnote, you can see that you're reflecting upon this idea of tradition throughout. And I think towards the end of the book, you talk about Kushiri is working in concurrent and intimately connected traditions. I'm wondering if you could just talk a little bit about your notion of tradition and how you see these various things that we might often think as separate, right? Theology and mysticism and all these other things. How was this study of Kushiri and the Lata'if, how does it tie all these together?
No, thank you for this question. In many ways, I see Kushiri as standing at the confluence, right, of various traditions, and that the Sunni tradition writ large is really the construction or the bringing together of a variety of threads and strands, right? It's kind of like the weaving of a rope, taking, you know, individual strands and binding them together. That lengthy footnote which you came across essentially was my attempt to kind of tease out what is this notion of tradition. I mean, the notion of tradition comes up time and again throughout the literature, throughout the rhetoric. It manifests, with different vocabulary depending on which time period you're looking at. But there's this notion that there's this thing called tradition, and what is that? And what I'm trying to demonstrate, right, is the tradition is something that's organic. Right. I think when you're standing from within that community, you're looking at tradition as something that is fixed. It's your connection to the past. And what makes, what gives you authoritativeness, it gives you legitimacy, it provides guidance, right? It's your way of being anchored or connected to that sacred past, to the religious text, to the prophetic character, right? To what have you. And so while there's this perception of fixity, when you actually look at how the tradition unfolds, how tradition develops, right, you see that it's constantly changing and adjusting, right? The circumstances of the time, social forces, political forces, have an impact on how the tradition will adapt to survive, right? Because a tradition is also something that is literally passed down, transmitted from one generation to the other. And with that transition, right, there is this element of preservation, but there's also an element of adaptation. I think that's something, right, with kind of modern historical consciousness we're able to see. And I'm trying to show that, yes, you know, Kushiri, he's part of his whole career is trying to argue that, you know, my position as a Shafi, as an Ashari, as a Sufi, is very much within the Sunni tradition, the Ahl-Sunnah. But it's a case he has to make, right? He has to construct a vision of the tradition to show that his place and his circle, right, fit into that larger community. And so that's why I thought the Lata'if is fantastic, because it shows all these smaller threads, these intellectual trends, these distinct compartmentalized disciplines being brought together to construct a larger vision of what Kushiri sees as, well, here's my Sunni tradition. This is how I fit in. This is how my circle, my network of individuals, of colleagues, scholars, family members fit into what I see as the larger Sunni tradition.
Yeah, I would recommend to potential readers to look specifically at this note in the I believe it's in the introduction. If you're one who skips footnotes, read that one, because it comes through throughout the book, and you do a very good job of tying all those threads together.
I should mention that this is something I'm trying to take up with one of my future book projects. Right, the next thing I have in the pipeline is essentially a work that's trying to look at the constructiveness of tradition, while also trying to look at, you know, how is continuity maintained in that very notion of constructiveness. But that can be for later.
Yeah. So this also, this idea of tradition leads us to sources, right? And you use a number of sources, both manuscript and then dozens and dozens of primary sources. I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about your sources and how you came across them, how you were working with them, and how they came across.
Well, essentially, I developed over the course of my work, my research, what I would call manuscript fever, right? when it comes to Qushayri and the Lataif Isharat, it is something that's been edited, it's been printed. There is really no need necessarily to go and consult the manuscripts, right? You can kind of take it for granted that, you know, someone's done the work, they've taken the time to comb through this text and produce a print edition that can be readily available, that things should stop there. But, you know, this book isn't just about the Lataif. I would say that the first part, the first few chapters, is just trying to provide a more rigorous profile for who Qushayri is, right? Give us an intellectual biography. And part of that is trying to unearth all the other texts that he's producing. Because he's not just dealing with Sufi texts, right? We can find theological treatises. We can find poetry, right? We can find all sorts of kind of different works, like commentaries on the divine names and so on. And so in trying to map out, right, the textual character or the textual legacy that Qushayri leaves behind, I had to begin to look to manuscripts. And I'm glad I did, because one of the fortunate things that I discovered along the way, thanks to other colleagues working at Qushayri, is that the Lataif al-Isharat itself, right, a book that has been printed, edited, has certain errors or has certain aspects missing, right, that we've discovered now, other manuscripts that seem to indicate that there are elements in the commentary that were excluded from the print edition that's readily available. And while that doesn't make a big impact in the findings that I come across in this book, Sufi Master and Quran Scholar, I think it's noteworthy, right? For any scholar who's going to be working Qushayri in the future, there is still a need to consult the manuscript tradition. And so this took me, right, pretty much across the Atlantic. I spent time primarily in Istanbul looking through the archives in the Sulaymaniyah, seeing what was available there. And of course, there's archives in London, in Princeton, that I took advantage of, and also in Cairo recently. But, you know, it's painstaking work, but it's extremely rewarding, extremely fulfilling when you actually go and do this. Because when you pick up a manuscript, or you look at least, I guess the trend now is to look at a digitized version of a manuscript, you're looking at, you know, the very page that a scholar used himself in studying this text by Qushayri or whoever you're investigating. And I think that made the experience a bit more real, right? That this is very much a lived tradition, that what Qushayri contributes is the text that he's composing was passed down. It was hand copied, right? It was preserved. It was treasured. It was taken up and studied. So I think that dimension of turning to the manuscripts made, I think, my experience of doing this research much more gratifying.
Now, could you tell us a little bit about the Lataif itself? You know, what it looks like, the structure, the style, and maybe specifically you could talk about how it was composed, and possibly in relation to what type of audience, since we know a lot of works during this time were just copied during speaking. So could you tell us a little bit about that as well?
Sure. I mean, this isn't conclusive, but my own thesis is that this is a text that was being delivered orally, right? That he's presenting the Lataif al-Isharat before a group of students, of disciples, of individuals who look to Qushayri as a spiritual master, who want to get his insights on what the Quran means for them. And so the structure of the Lataif is very deliberate. Right, the way that he composes it, he uses a range of registers. Right, you can tell by the tone of voice that he's using the nature of the message he's trying to convey. Right, and one of the points that I try to make throughout the book is that you can really see kind of a ladder of interpretation. That when he comes to a verse that has higher potential for a multiplicity of possibilities. Right, he typically begins with the most conventional interpretation, right? What will you find in a typical tafsir? The grammatical explanation, a poetic reference, perhaps. But then he'll build upon that, right? He's trying to provide that basic knowledge that he may extrapolate and say, well, here's also a legal ruling that you can have, or perhaps here's a theological implication that you have. And you see through via this ladder of interpretation that his concern or priority is escalating, right? It's rising higher and higher. And at the apex of these kind of ladders of interpretation, that's when he provides that mystical insight. That's when he tries to provide some sort of spiritual reality for this particular verse. And so this is where I see, right? You can imagine that Kusheri is seated before his students and he's trying to instruct them. Right? He has a pedagogical purpose in mind. Let me explain to you, right, that with this Quranic verse, you should have this basic foundational knowledge in mind. But once you have that, realize that there are higher realities, right, higher levels that one can understand. And that's when he delves into the more mystically oriented kind of hermeneutics. And you know, this doesn't happen with every verse, but it does happen quite often. And if you just, you know, pick up and randomly open the commentary itself, his style of language, right, when he's speaking from his own voice, is when he's kind of delving to the more eloquent Arabic, right? When he's playing with words, he's dealing with kind of rhymed prose. It's when this language is used that you realize that he's trying to impart some sort of mystical truth or mystical insight. Right? When he's trying to do that more base, conventional explanation, you know, his sentences are very simple. It's straightforward. Let me get this point, you know, conveyed to you as clearly and as succinctly as possible. And so you see this range.
Now, Martin, in the first couple chapters, you basically try to lay out kind of the historical context that Kusheri is working in. Could you tell us a little bit about this, maybe who his masters were, who his important contemporaries were? You know, Nishapur becomes very important. Maybe you could talk about some of the social political happenings that would be influential in Kusheri's life and how he might interpret the Quran.
Right. I mean, what I've just spoken about is really kind of just one level of appreciating where this text comes from. Right. We kind of have this sense of the immediacy in which the immediacy of the audience that he's trying to reach out to. Right. Who is he trying to speak to? But we also need to realize that his whole life, right, is mired within kind of the political intrigue, the competition that's going back and forth within his situation. Right. He's living in Nishapur, this intellectual crossroads. It's a very cosmopolitan city. You have all these different groups that are present, all of them vying for prominence, if not power. Right, within this one city. And if you go back and just look through the biographical dictionaries, many of the prominent names that we know today, right, have some connection to Nishapur, that they spent time there, they traveled there to study. It was definitely a place that one would go to seek knowledge. And so the Lataif is very much a product of this, that it's not something that's, you know, written in a vacuum. It's not written by some sort of spiritual master in retreat. Right? He's in the city, part of that of the political web that's there. And in that respect, right, we can read, for example, the theological aspects of the commentary. Well, that's reflecting his advocacy of the Ash'ari school. And so to kind of provide a bit of background of what Nishapur is like, it very much was divided at this time between a number of factions. You have, we have the Shia, who are in one neighborhood of the city. You have the Hanafis, who constitute another major group. And you have the Shafis, to which Kusheri, you know, identifies with. This is the network with which he's been studying. It's the network with which he's connected through marriage, and so these aspects all are going to have some effect, right, on or have some role to play in informing how to interpret and understand the Lataif. And the Lataif itself too is something that's written when Kusheri is older. He's in his 60s by the time he begins it. We can then imagine that this commentary very much is you know, the culmination of a lifetime of meditation. That he's been reflecting and working with the Quran throughout his life. He's been studying under the tutelage of other great masters, and now it's his turn, right? Now in his 60s to compose something here. And he's doing tafsir, right? I mean, this activity of engaging with the Quran is something that he's consciously doing as a scholarly activity. And this is something that I think is interesting about Nishapur, that the act of composing a tafsir was a way of asserting one's scholarly identity, of one's association. And this is something that I touch upon in the book, and I've made explicit elsewhere, is that in the city of Nishapur itself, the Shafi group was very much invested in producing tafsir. It was seen as an activity that one did to essentially establish your kind of the boundaries of how you saw the tradition. And so when Kusheri writes a tafsir, he's essentially imitating many of his other masters, right? He studies with the great Sufi master Abu Abdurrahman al-Sulami, who's very well known for composing a variety of works, the tafsir of himself. And you can see in Kushairi's tafsir the influence of Sulami. But, you know, Kushairi also studies with the Ash'ari theologian Ibn Furuq, who also composes a tafsir. Right? And those theological elements, those concerns, seem to get translated or transferred over into Kushairi's concerns. There's even elements of Shafi jurisprudence, things that he would have picked up from his teachers, like Abu Bakr al-Tusi, right, that, you know, are being expressed and how he interprets verses there. And so I think these other teachers who are in the city, who are already doing tafsir, who are teaching Kushairi, right, it's feeding into this tradition of if you're going to be a scholar of the Shafi school, right, well, then you should be engaging with a tafsir yourself. And part of my argument is that there really is a school of Quranic exegesis in Nishapur, that this is something that we perhaps don't see as prominent or as prevalent in other cities across the Muslim world at this time. Not to say that tafsir wasn't being done, but just given the evidence that we have, right? Nishapur is definitely one major locus in which tafsir was being produced, right? You have individuals like Tha'alabi, who Walid Saleh has done an excellent study on and demonstrating, right, the critical importance of tafsir for him and his lineage. But there's others in those cities, right? Like Sulami, like Kushairi, Kharbushi, another Sufi who's doing an explanation of the Quran in his works. Clearly, this work of tafsir is something of great import for one scholarly identity, specifically, or especially rather, for the Shafis.
Now, once you start getting to the actual text, you begin by kind of going through some of the just the basics about the style of it. And one of the things that happens, especially in the introduction, is you talk about almost how Kushairi sees his commentary. He talks about these the differences between ilm and ma'rifa. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about that introduction where he talks about these distinctions and what he does with them.
All right. This is something he actually makes very explicit, for example, when he deals with the famous verse on the muhkam and mutashabihat, right? The clear and the ambiguous verses of the Quran in verse 3-7. And so this is a great way of trying to show how does Kushairi see this difference between ilm and ma'rifa. And I think it has very much to do with this ladder of interpretation I'm describing, that he sees knowledge as hierarchical, right? And that yes, you must have a strong foundation as a traditional religious scholar, studying things like hadith and Quran and law and theology. And that, you know, that represents this you know, basic level of understanding that all scholars should attain. But he also recognizes, right, as someone who's part of the Sufi tradition, who recognizes that there's this thing called the Sufi path, that there is a higher attainment of knowledge, something that is bequeathed by God, this thing called ma'rifah. Right, and these are spiritual insights that one can attain. But make sure, if you're going to try to pursue this path, if you're going to try to look for ma'rifah, you have your credentials established, right? That you actually know the more conventional, basic understandings, the foundations of the religion, before you try to penetrate into these higher realities. And so I think when he talks about, for example, the clear and the ambiguous verses, when he talks about the mutashabihat, he actually says that these ambiguous verses are actually accessible by human beings. This is not something that is only within the ken or within the realm of God's knowledge. Humans can actually attain this too, but it's something that God bequeaths, right? And this gets back to this notion of ma'rifah, right? That, you know, that God can endow, can grant to certain individuals of perhaps a greater clarity or insight to understanding these verses that seem a little less accessible than others.
Yeah, so you note that these and some other ideas are interpretive categories that basically situate Kushairi's tafsir within this kind of broader school that you're talking about. The other interpretive category that you talk about is abrogation. Can you talk a little bit about his understanding of abrogation?
Oh, yes. Well, he subscribes to the, I would say, the typically mainstream view within you know, the field of Quranic studies for that time period, right? That, you know, this is that there are verses which can be abrogated, that they can be replaced or substituted with a later verse for whatever reason, right? That through God's wisdom, things have changed. And he provides a very conventional definition of nasq, abrogation, when it's mentioned in the relevant verses. But then he also, right, kind of following that notion of a hierarchical or ladder of interpretation, he'll then begin to transform that and say that, you know, this notion of abrogation, well, we can actually almost transform this idea into something more spiritual. And he gets into highly symbolic language, and that's where you get really a taste for his more mystical insights, where he's trying to make it relevant to these, to the circle of students that's seated in front of him, trying to understand, you know, what are these greater depths we can ascertain. Well, you know, even the concept of nesqa seems, which this notion of abrogation, which seems so kind of conventional in terms of dealing with Quran in perhaps a legal manner, can also be a way of understanding how the cosmos works, right? And so, you know, you can actually refer to that section of that chapter to get the kind of a taste for the language he's using.
So in the following chapter, you talk about this idea of attribution. And one of the things that's really interesting about the Lata'if is he doesn't really specifically cite people.
Yeah.
So could you talk about how Qushayri is using his sources in the Lata'if itself, and why that's noteworthy? Why is that interesting?
Well, it made my work incredibly difficult, right? Because when you open a typical tafsir, a typical commentary, you will find some sort of attribution of you know, who is your authority? Where do you hear this from, right? If you open Tabari or Thalibi, there's typically some sort of reference to tell you that, you know, here's the chain of transmission, or here's the figure from which I'm getting this from. But with Qushayri, very rarely does any sort of attribution ever appear. The one name that appears semi-consistently is his first spiritual master, right? The person who turns him onto the Sufi path, this figure, Abu Ali Ad-Daqaq, a Sufi master who leaves behind no written record himself, but was incredibly influential on Qushayri. And Qushayri will actually name him, and he only names him five times. And so, and this is the most referenced authority you find in the Lata'if itself, which just, you know, tells you how few names actually appear here. But this is noteworthy simply because it seems to go against convention. I think it feeds into my own argument that this demonstrates kind of the oral character of the delivery of the text itself. It demonstrates that, you know, there's a pedagogical purpose here. He's trying to impart, right, his interpretations, these readings of the Quran, and that the authorities are taking a back seat because his audience, right, are these Sufi disciples, these aspirants to the path. And so his emphasis is more about the content, the meaning, what we can derive from the verses of the Quran, rather than the various sources upon which he's drawing. But this, of course, is difficult for me, right? Because as I'm working through this text, I'm interested in the traditions that he's borrowing from. And so part of the process was trying to isolate, you know, certain kind of key studies, cases within the text itself that I could turn to and say, well, can I mine this information? And do perhaps comparative readings with contemporary or earlier sources to get a sense of, well, who is he using? All right, so maybe he's not naming individuals, but can we look at the interpretations that he's offering and find traditions, right, lineages of specific opinions that are passed down generation after generation, right? You know, if he's you know, studying with Sulaimi, who writes the tafsir, can I read Sulaimi's commentary and read Qushayri's commentary and find linkages? Can I look at Ibn Furuk's commentary and Qushayri's commentary and find linkages? And so this opened up a new frontier for my research, right? It pretty much forced me to do a very close reading of these key case studies that I focused in on. And the case studies that I eventually selected were the disconnected or disjointed letters of the Quran, right, these haruf and muqata'a that appear in front of 29 different surahs, the narratives having to do with the Prophet Ayyub or Job, and then the miraj, right, the ascension, the heavenly ascension. Can we find a genealogy of opinions rooted in these three case studies? And that's how I went about essentially trying to figure out who are these influences, who are the sources, or the possible traditions which Qushayri was encountering.
Martin, I think this is great, possibly because I have to do the same thing in my work. but from a more kind of methodological standpoint, where do you see kind of the limits of this approach? I certainly think it's valuable, and I think the case studies you use demonstrate that there are these kind of interconnections. But I mean, you from what you wrote in the book and from other conversations, I know you've thought about this, you know, pretty extensively. So how far can we take that kind of approach, do you think?
Well, I think the critical point with this type of approach is that it's always indeterminate, right? When Kushieri himself is never explicit, when he never names the sources he's using, when he doesn't provide, you know, some sort of reference or obvious key, the work that one does in terms of comparative reading is purely speculative, right? So yes, you know, Kushieri, you know, for example, we know that he studied with Suleiman, but you know, unless we can find some hard evidence, or do we actually know that he actually was able to read the texts that Suleiman wrote? Or perhaps he's hearing things in passing when he's sitting at the feet of Suleiman and listening to the lessons as a student. I think there's always this question that, all right, so maybe he and Tha'alabi are part of a shared tradition, but you know, were they really in conversation with one another? Or are they drawing upon a common text? We can never be sure, you know, of you know, where the actual source is. We can say at best they're from a particular lineage or tradition, that they're engaging with a common tradition, but we can't actually say that Kushieri met with A or B or C. We can only speculate, conjecture, right, that this might be the case. And I think it's a challenge it's a difficulty that it's hard to avoid, especially when you're doing something comparative. But it's, you know, in a case like this, it may be the only recourse or perhaps the best recourse available.
Yeah. You don't talk about the relationship in this specific part in the book, but maybe you could talk a little bit about his earlier tafsir and how that makes more explicit and maybe why he wrote a second.
Oh, yes, yes. I think what the Lotaf represents, right, is something that is written in kind of the height of his career. But, you know, if you really comb through the biographical information of Kushieri, you realize that he was engaged with tafsir pretty much from very early on. Right? Once he begins his formal study of the religious sciences, he's doing tafsir. And an article that really complements this work or builds upon the third chapter of this book, I tried to explore these earlier commentaries. The problem is these earlier commentaries don't exist as a whole. We have fragments that claim to be this earlier commentary, but we're not quite sure. But what I think it shows is definitely progression. And I've looked at two manuscripts that claim to be these early commentaries of Kushieri, and it's very clear that, you know, when Kushieri starts out, he's very much, you know, in the midst of his conventional education as a Sunni scholar. He's studying tafsir from a very mainstream position. And by the time, you know, he reaches, you know, the venerable sixth decade of his life, right, he's advanced. He's now, you know, incorporating that conventional understanding of things, but now he's bringing to it like the weight of his authority as a Sufi master. But it's clear that, you know, this is something that's sustained. And what's interesting is that the earlier tafsir, it's more clear there that the nature of the delivery of his exegesis of the Quran was oral. It was something done in regular sessions, right? That he's trying to really teach students, and so that I think helped me come to the conclusion that the Lataf itself is, you know, it's just following that same pattern, and you can see that in the text. But you know, very much that, you know, this notion of exegesis is something that permeates his life, that his concern for the Quran is just seen in the way he talks about Sufism, say in the Rasala, but also in his close engagement in these various commentaries that he composes.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but don't others think that it was not delivered orally?
Oh, that the text was delivered orally?
Yeah.
Oh, that was it not?
Did I read that incorrectly? I thought you mentioned somewhere that others argue that it was written
I would say the other opinion that's kind of floating out there isn't necessarily in opposition, right, to the idea that it was delivered orally, but it's clear from the language that it's very carefully composed, right? It's highly poetic, so there must have been a lot of deliberation put into the composition of the language. But in my mind, that doesn't necessarily contradict the notion that the commentary could be delivered orally, right? It could be delivered kind of extemporaneously. You know, some people have a gift with language. And I think he's an individual you know, who after, you know, six decades of life has attained a certain degree of eloquence, that he's able to kind of speak extemporaneously, or at least speak with a certain deliberateness from a spontaneous moment. I wouldn't say that the other opinions out there are necessarily at odds with his notion of public discourse. I think they can actually be made, they can be reconciled.
Sure. Now, maybe you could walk us through some of these case studies that you do and what they kind of reveal to us.
Sure.
I don't know if you have a preference. You talk about the Mihraj, you talk about these disconnected letters. They all kind of reveal different things to us. So, I mean, you can walk us through all of them if you'd like, but.
Well, yeah, I can start with at least those two cases. The Mihraj is interesting because it shows the progression of Kusheri from within his own career. Because with that particular case, I'm looking, you know, at the verses that deal with the ascension, right? Things that, for example, appear in the 53rd surah, right? The first several verses of that surah deal with this notion of the Mihraj. And, of course, I'm looking at the Lata'if, but he also wrote a book called the Kitab-e-Mihraj, the Book of the Ascension. And this is an interesting book because it's very eclectic. It's drawing upon a lot of different fields, right? The book opens with looking at the hadith that report on the Prophet Muhammad's ascension into heaven. Then it turns to kind of these theological issues. When did it happen? When did it take place? From which city did it transpire? Did Muhammad go on the ascension in a bodily fashion? Was it in a dream, by spirit? But then it turns to Sufis who go on. And then the book ends with a proper commentary of the Quran, at least on the beginning of Surah 53, Surah An-Najm. And so what I did with this case study is I looked at Kitab-e-Mihraj, written by Kusheri in the Lata'if, and his treatment of that same section, and tried to do a very close reading to show that there's continuity, to show that, you know, there's a certain carry over there, but there are also certain differences. I think you can see development. And again, you know, in this case, one can't be certain which comes first, but my feeling is the Lata'if Sharat is something that has a more mature feel to it. Right? There's a certain kind of developedness or a more kind of advanced insight into what these verses possibly mean. And so I use that case study to actually try to track Kusheri's own development, his own kind of approach to the ascension itself. With the Huruf Muqatta'a, right, these disconnected letters, this is something which was much more fruitful in trying to show the other traditions, right? Other kind of schools of exegesis that Kusheri is drawing upon. Because, you know, if you're going to write a commentary of the Quran, you go verse by verse, you will invariably have to deal with these disconnected letters. And so I was able to really kind of to pull or draw out the different interpretations from his contemporaries, like Al-Wahidi, Al-Tha'labi, and earlier figures like At-Taburi, Sulami, At-Tustari, right? People from who are writing very Sufi commentaries, people are writing encyclopedic commentaries, to those who are situated in Nishapur, right? His fellow Nishapuri Mufassirin, the other exegetes of the Quran from the city of Nishapur. And when I was able to actually set these all side by side, I was able to actually dispel a certain kind of misconception, right? There was a theory earlier that Kusheri's tafsir is nothing more really than kind of an expansion upon Sulami's tafsir. And while, you know, you can look at the disconnected letters and say, okay, you're right, I can see the strong influence of Sulami on some of the opinions that Kusheri presents. And Kusheri presents, I think, about 13 different interpretations for the first set of disconnected letters to appear in the Quran. You know, well, that resonance with Sulami is actually with only two or three opinions. But then you turn to someone like Taburi, and you see there's much more, that he's more inclined to draw upon the encyclopedic tradition. And then you turn to Tha'labi, right, his contemporary, someone who's more senior than him, someone he has respect for as interpreter of the Quran, and you see a greater resonance there. And it's clear that, you know, Kusheri is very much operating within the sphere of Nishapuri exegesis, and he's more willing, or he has more access to the Nishapuri tradition. And so you see greater affinity between him and Tha'labi and Wahidi when it comes to the disconnected letters than, say, with the others, at least on a numerical level. And so I use, right, you can turn to the disconnected letters and actually see, in this case, all right, so here's all these various traditions he's drawing upon, but now we see there's a greater preponderance with his fellow Nishapuris from the Shafi tradition. right? And those who are doing more conventional encyclopedic type work than even the Sufi ones, right? And if, and what's also great about the mysterious, or rather the disconnected letters that Kushiri deals with, you see opinions that are original to him. You actually see opinions that he himself is formulating for which there is no precedent, right? He's articulating in his own fashion. He's using his own voice. And we can find some cases where we actually see Kushiri developing his own interpretation after having presented everything else.
Yeah, maybe you could tell us a little bit about what he says about these.
Oh, sure. So, you know, some of the conventional ones I'll mention is that, that you know, one popular opinion that's repeated over and over again is that the letters, these disconnected letters, are a secret of God, right? And that essentially it's an interpretation that leads to consignment. We consign the knowledge or the true meaning of these letters to God alone. And you find that pretty much across the board. People continually refer to the letters as a secret. You'll find that in Sosteri, you'll find that in Thalib. But then you'll have things where they take the letters and try to, like Aleph, Lam, Mim, A-L-M, and they try to find equivalents, right? So the Aleph, you know, that's Allah, and the Lam stands for Jibreel, and the M is for Muhammad. Or perhaps the letters Aleph, Lam, Mim for Kushiri represent attributes of God, right? The Mim represents Majd, right? The majesty of God. But the ones that I think are most interesting is, for example, is when he actually looks at the nature of the letters themselves, right? He looks at the Aleph. Right, the letter Aleph, all it is a single stroke, right, going from up to down. And he sees this, right, as the servant, right, before God, standing, right, alone, right? And it's a recognition of every servant before God in isolation. It's a representation of the unity of the divine. He even looks at the way that the letters connected, how Arabic is written, right? Some letters connected to others and others are not. And he meditates on how, you know, for example, Aleph, Lam, Mim, we can look at these forms and see, right, the place of the human being before the divine. And there's a certain degree of creativity, of imagination here, which I think is interesting, right? That here's a Sufi master who looks at Aleph, Lam, Mim, and rather than trying to actually say that, you know, you can look at these letters and this is what it actually means, he's saying, well, you know, how could we understand it? How can we actually derive something fulfilling or meaningful from those letters? I think it's more about signification or rather meaning making than actually trying to find, you know, what does God intend with these?
Now, can you talk a little bit about this idea of the stories of the prophets that we have in the Quran and use Job, of course, to kind of exemplify this?
Oh, yes. Well, the situation with the prophets in the Quran is that, you know, we have so many different prophets named in the Quran itself, but when it comes to constructing the narratives, the information, biographical information, you know, what goes on, what takes place, where the trials and tribulations they go through, the Quran doesn't necessarily give us the full picture, because part of it is that the audience, you know, at the time knew, they were familiar with these stories. Right? The illusion was enough to kind of set in their minds that, oh, this is why, this is why Job is actually mentioned, that we know what Job goes through. And so we don't need to have all those details. But, you know, as time passes, as the centuries kind of accumulate, there's a distancing. And part of the job of the exegete was trying to fill in those blanks, trying to figure out, well, what's going on? And so, for example, of Job, there's really only two places in the Quran, and it's a handful of verses that deal with the narrative of Job. But then you can look to Qisas al-Anbiya literature, right? The tales of the prophets. And you look to other tafsir, other commentaries to get a sense of, well, how did the scholars try to explain, you know, who Job was? You know, what do we know about his trials and tribulations? And so when I turn to this, you know, we actually see that Kushiri, when he's trying to you know, explain certain situations, he's drawing upon, for example, Thalibi's tales of the prophets in addition to the commentary of the Quran. And I think one of the interesting points, for example, with the story of Job, right, is that, you know, Job cries out. You know, he cries out from this affliction that he's suffering. And for Kushiri, you know, as an Ash'ari theologian, he's trying to find an interpretation that protects Job from showing some sort of doubt or complaint or frustration or despair, right, against God. And so for example, one of the interesting interpretations he brings up, right, is that cry of affliction isn't from Job itself, right? It's from the affliction that Job is suffering, right? That the physical boils or whatnot are crying out. Like, that's what's actually crying out to God, not Job. And I think this reveals, for example, you know, the Asheri concern of Husheri. It's small, subtle things like this where we can kind of draw those larger lines connecting to Husheri to different schools and traditions.
Yeah, maybe we can skip ahead to that because you do have a whole chapter on mm-hmm. this idea of his Asherism. How do you see this coming through? You talk about him being, you know, kind of this elder representative of this school at the time.
Yeah.
Why is it so important for him for this to come through in his tafsir? And how does it?
Oh, sure. Well, I think this is perhaps one of the more riveting aspects of his biography. He's in the city of Nishapur, where there's all these factions. The Hanafis and the Shafis at this time period just do not get along. And when the Seljuks, right, this new power, they move in and they establish rule in the city of Nishapur, there really is this very heated contestation for influence. And essentially, at one point, right, or rather building over a number of years, there's an intensification of scrutiny against the Asheris. And the Asheris are clearly associated with the Shafis at this time, right? And so Husheri gets embroiled in this huge debate on, well, is Abul Hasan al-Asheri, right, the founder of this school of theology, is he even part of the Ahl-Sunnah? Is he actually part of the Sunni tradition, right? This is a question that's brought before him. And he issues a fatwa, right, as a religious scholar, he issues a fatwa that is co-signed, right, by a dozen other Shafi scholars, trying to say, yes, he is of course part of the Sunni tradition. The fact that he has to make this case, right, speaks to kind of the heated debate over who belongs and who does not. But then this escalates even further, because once the Seljuks move in, they're swayed to oppose the Shafi Asheris even further. And what happens is that the Asheris, along with the Shia, are cursed from the pulpits, right? For when the Friday prayer takes place, when the city congregates in these large congregational mosques, right? The khatib, the preacher, he has to, you know, he's ordered to condemn the Shia. He's ordered to condemn the Asheris. As you can imagine, you know, here's Husheri, who's an ardent advocate of the Asheris. He's written this fatwa defending Abul Hasan Asheri. You know, he's now being targeted, right? And this is actually this is seen as this persecution of Asheris during the time. That in the city of Nishapur especially, that the Asheris were heavily persecuted. Many of them actually had to flee. And Husheri himself is named among three others to be arrested, right? And the one of the other famous people is actually Imam al-Haramain al-Juwayni, this great theologian, you know, and, you know, he gains this name, Imam al-Haramain, right, the religious scholar of the two sacred sanctuaries. He gains it because he has to flee to Mecca and Medina because of this persecution. Right? And so what happens is when the issue, the edict, the warrant for their arrest is issued, Juwayni, he's on the road. So he's like, you know what, I'm not in the city, I'm not going back. He heads, you know, he's able to kind of move on and go on pilgrimage to kind of escape this persecution. Husheri's in the city, and he's actually arrested. And he's in the 70s at this point. So you can imagine, right, a 70-year-old man being dragged off to prison. And, you know, the story doesn't really end there, because his compatriots, you know, these ardent Shafi Asheris, they actually raise a small band of men, the soldiers, and they actually go and assault the city. There's actually this conflict, right? The description is that the marketplace is filled with arrows. The people holding Husheri, the authorities refuse to let him go. Blood is shed, and eventually they realize they've lost ground, and they concede. They free Husheri, and Husheri leaves. And of course, well, now that, you know, he's free, he can't really stay, because still there's this notion of persecution. The Asheris are still being cursed from the pulpits. They're being denied positions of importance. And Husheri does what any person will do. He goes on vacation. He goes on pilgrimage, and he heads down to Mecca. And you have this whole caravan of religious scholars who go down to Mecca with him. He's going with Juwayni at this point. But you can see, right, that his very life, right, late in his life, is deeply influenced to his commitment to Asherism, right? That his advocacy of Asherism, his leadership of the Shafi Asheri faction within the city, results in his arrest. Now, the Lata'if al-Sharat is not written after this. It's actually written before this. It's written during the period when the Asheri persecution is ramping up. It hasn't happened yet, but it's on the horizon. They can see it coming. So given this knowledge, right, that history will unfold in this way, that it's very palpable for scholars like Kusheri at this time that, you know, Asheris are being persecuted, or rather they're being targeted, that, you know, there's a need to assert the legitimacy of it. And so when I turned to the Lata'if, I started looking, right, well, where can we find evidence of Kusheri asserting his Asheri identity or asserting a positions of an Asheri nature? And one of the more prominent examples that I found has to do with the nature of God himself. How is he depicted? The issue of Tashbih, right? What we might say is likening, but really this notion of anthropomorphism. Verses of the Quran that seem to describe God in an anthropomorphic way, right? Giving him human qualities, that he's seated upon the throne, that he has a hand, right? That he has position. That he's part of time in some sense. So I was curious, you know, well, how does Kusheri respond to this? And as befits any good Asheri theologian, what does Kusheri do? Right? He articulates positions that are very much in line with the larger school itself, right? Tries to take the anthropomorphic bite out of the verse and say that, you know, there's other ways of looking at this, right? There's other interpretations that are valid. And so, right, you can see, right, that here's this figure, Kusheri, a great Sufi master, but also a vested Asheri theologian, expressing these same concerns in his tafsir, right? When he's teaching his students, right, it very much, the commentary that he gives mirrors his own concerns and predilections.
Now, you also have a chapter that does a similar job in asserting his Shafi identity.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. This is much more subtle, and I felt it was actually, I had to do a much closer reading or combing through the text to find it, but it's there, right? He presents a lot of juridical opinions, and many of them are you know, obviously going to be shared across different madhahib. But, you know, I was able to find certain instances, for example, where client or more prominent among Shafi interpretations. One of the examples comes from the 108th surah of the Quran, Fasalli li rabbika wanhar, right? And that wanhar means and sacrifice. But among certain Shafi's interpretations, so you actually find this notion that, you know, that also can mean be a reference to the positions, the position of the hands during prayer, right? That you put it to the chest nahar, right? And so, you know, that's just kind of a small example of how I was trying to show that, you know, Kusheri was clearly familiar and perhaps even gave a certain degree of preference to Shafi interpretations when it mattered. But I think it's less pronounced than the Asheri one, because Asherism was something that was actually pinpointed, whereas the Shafi identity wasn't necessarily contested on its I don't know, Shafiness itself. But, you know, that chapter was trying to show that, you know, just as there's a theological reflection, there's also a legal reflection of Kusheri's concerns.
Yeah, and I think both of them are very important, because you do a great job of, you talk earlier in the book about how this tafsir has just been called simply a mystical tafsir, right?
Yes.
A mystical commentary. So I think you do a very good job of showing that these multiple elements or these traditions coming together, right? In the final chapter, you do kind of return to this idea of mysticism, though. I'm wondering if you'd talk a little bit about some of the more prominent things that Kusheri speaks of. When you talk about this idea of miracles, becomes very important.
All right. Just, you know, part of, if you look at, you know, for example, the Risala, his other famous work, which is written at the same time as Lata'if, you know, this, the notion of miracles, of extraordinary things happening at the hands of other spiritual masters, is very much part of the worldview, right, of Sufism. And one has to try to, well, if you're going to be an Asheri theologian, right, as well as a Sufi, you need to somehow reconcile this. Because typically the notion of miracles is generally associated with prophets, right? Prophets perform miracles to help to help affirm the truthfulness of the message that they bring, right? It serves to support their mission. So what does it mean then that others who are nonprofits actually seem to have miracles? And so I return to this issue, which is of a theological concern, but also of a special important concern for Sufis. You know, how do they deal with this notion of karama, right? Miracles that happen at the hand of non-prophets, non-prophetic miracles. And I look at both the Risala and the Lataf Ishara to see how does he resolve this issue. And I very deliberately put these Sufi concerns at the end of the book, right? Because I'm trying to show that with the vast majority of the text itself, of the text that I wrote, right, that, you know, Kusheri is doing so many other things at the same time. But I felt important to still include at the very end, right, that, you know, he still has Sufi concerns. And in fact, it would be incorrect to say that this is not a Sufi tafsir. It's a Sufi tafsir that does so many other things. But, you know, I wanted to also kind of put it at the end to also reflect that ladder of interpretation that Kusheri does, right? That you start with the conventional and then you move up to the more important issues, right? And so for Kusheri, right, you have to put in that legal material, but definitely make sure you put that Ashari identity there. Then, of course, Simos always ends, right, with that Sufi note. And I wanted the book to end with that same note. And while the book itself doesn't delve too deeply into the mystical interpretations that's there, that really wasn't my purpose in composing the text itself, right? And doing this research, I wanted to show what else is there in Kusheri's hermeneutics. What else can we read in the text? And, you know, I really see the book as a stepping stone for further study of Kusheri and his works. And I think, you know, while this may be an important look into the Lataf Isharat, I don't see it as the last definitive examination of it. There's certainly more work to be done, and there's a host of other scholars now who are turning to Kusheri. And so I hope that this book and what I've done with it will kind of contribute in a constructive way to future scholarship on him and his environment.
Yeah, and it sounds like that's already happening, right? You mentioned that there's a translation underway, I believe, and you just, if I remember correctly, didn't you just edit a issue for the Journal of Sufi Studies on Kusheri?
Right. The most recent volume of the Journal of Sufi Studies is a collection of papers dedicated to Kusheri and his legacy. Right. It was actually a very nice panel that we originally put together for the American Academy of Religion. All of us decided that this was a good idea to kind of expand on this and to build on our presentations. And so now you can actually go to the Journal of Sufi Studies and see these further steps along the way in trying to gain greater clarity on who Kusheri is and how he fits into the larger tradition.
Have you been? It's Kristen Sands is the one translating. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any idea when that is going to be done? I don't know if you've been in contact with her about this or.
Oh, not recently, but you know, it's an unenviable task it's an admirable one, but also unenviable simply because Kusheri's, you know, text has very eloquent and difficult to translate language, right? I mean, there are certain particularities to Arabic that are hard to bring into any sort of idiomatic English. And it's mystical to boot, right? It's also dealing with these high concepts. It's highly symbolic. How do you translate that there? It's understandable that this is going to be painstaking work, but, you know, I think the effort itself will be a great contribution. I think there's even other studies being produced now on Kusheri's Lataif. But, you know, as I said, I think this book is really kind of the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, you've done a great job, Martin. And since we know you're not going to be translating this yourself, maybe you could tell us a little bit about some of the things you are working on.
Sure. There's actually, I guess, three things that I've been kind of dabbling with. I'm trying to work on a translation of the Kitab al-Miraj. I think it's a worthwhile project just because it approaches the issue of the heavenly ascension from so many different angles, right? And from the view of, I think, of a very important, interesting scholar. I'm also trying to begin work on the tafsir of one of Kusheri's teachers, Ibn Furuk, a prominent Ashari theologian who also has a very interesting life, right? He's poisoned on the road. That's how he dies, because he has to defend himself before the court of a Muslim ruler defending his positions. And so part of his tafsir survives, and I want to do a similar treatment of that work. But the work I'm really focusing on now is actually a work of Muslim theology, trying to show kind of a macro view of what's going on within the Islamic tradition in terms of theology, and not just the conventional conventional theology we imagine, Ilm al-Kalam or Aqida, but that theology is being done in many other forms, and try to bring it up to the contemporary period to see, well, what's happening now in a constructive manner. So these are kind of all on tap, but I think they all are born out of my interests in Kusheri and the research that I've done so far on him.
Now, you also have this kind of ongoing project, Islamicana. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. It's a website that I maintain with my wife, Kiran Tahir. It essentially is a means of documenting, you know, kind of all those interesting tidbits and anecdotes that you discover along the way. And so it's a blend of things we've discovered about, you know, the heritage of Muslims in the U.S., right, Islam in America. It documents things we've discovered on our journeys to do research, right? There's quite a bit of information on Islam in Turkey, Istanbul especially. And it's also kind of a place to kind of bring together the work that we're doing, right? So you can find articles that I've published there. It's become my clearinghouse for all things interesting, but perhaps not long enough to be an article or publishable.
Well, I've been enjoying those too, so I hope you do keep that up.
I certainly will.
Well, thanks, Martin. We appreciate your time, and we certainly hope to get you back for some of these future projects.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for listening. That was my interview with Martin Nguyen about his book Sufi Master and Quran Scholar Abul Qasim al-Kushairi and the Lataf al-Isharat, which was published by Oxford University Press in 2012.